Welcome to First Fuel, a podcast bringing new perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management, demand response, and the energy transition taking place in Canada and around the world. I'm Corey Diamond, Executive Director of Efficiency Canada, and this week I'm joined by Luke Menzel. Luke is CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, Australia's peak body for energy efficiency, energy management, and demand response. Welcome, Luke. How are you?
Hey, Corey. Pleasure to be here.
So why don't we get in? Maybe we can start. Luke, tell me or tell the audience about the EEC and a little bit of the background and history so we have just a general context of what the organization's all about.
Yeah, sure. So the Energy Efficiency Council is the peak body for energy efficiency, energy management and demand response in Australia. So we have around 100 members, everything from small consultancies that are providing bespoke energy efficiency advice right through to multinationals like Siemens and Schneider Electric and the like. We also have local governments, we have universities, we have a number of other industry and professional associations that represent like manufacturers and the property sector, different parts of the economy. And so it's a pretty diverse group, but it's united in a common cause of elevating the role of energy efficiency, energy management, demand response in the energy transition that we're all working our way through. The genesis of the organisation really was back in the late 2000s, sort of 2008, 2009, we had a new progressive Labor government here in Australia. There was a lot of talk about climate change. It was sort of post-inconvenient truth. We had a drought here in Australia in the mid-2000s. There was a lot of concern and a lot of momentum towards climate action. It was an observation from the energy efficiency sector that we were talking a lot about renewables and the role of renewables in the transition. And obviously that's, as we all know, very important, but not a lot of talk about the role of the demand side in driving down carbon emissions. And so there's a view that we needed a voice as a sector. And they recruited the founding CEO, Rob Murray-Leach, who was still head of policy here at the Energy Efficiency Council, to found the organisation and really fly the flag for the role that energy efficiency can play and all of that, as well as all the other great things we know it can do in terms of health and comfort and saving money and the multiple benefits of energy efficiency that you there at Efficiency Canada are so familiar with.
Yeah, and it is interesting. Our history is very similar. Mm. This kind of need for a voice, this need to kind of exploit this pathway to decarbonizing. I'm curious on your end, because certainly one of my fun topics to talk about is the relationship we have with governments. Mm. Because certainly in Canada, there's been, some headway, and we have to always balance that, applauding and making sure we celebrate when good policies happen.
Yep.
But we're also a critic and we're an advocate. And I'm curious kind of how that works on your end with your members and maybe just give us a sense right now of like where things are, maybe federally or nationally in Australia with the government and your relationship with them.
Yeah, well, look, we, like you, aren't afraid to criticise. There is things about Australia's performance on energy efficiency to be disappointed by. So the global benchmark for energy efficiency policy performance is really the ACEEE's Global Energy Efficiency Scorecard that they release every 2 or 3 years. The most recent one, I think, was in 2019. And unhappily, Australia was 18 out of the 25 largest energy users in the world and the worst in the developed world on energy efficiency policy and performance. Now, that's not to say there aren't bright spots. We're actually doing pretty well on commercial buildings. We've got a pretty sophisticated set of policies and programs and ratings for commercial buildings, and we're in some ways leading the world with our National Australian Built Environment Rating System. And the other part of the story that, things like the ACEEE scorecard don't tell is kind of the differentiation in performance in terms of policy at the state level. And so we have states here in Australia that are just doing fabulous work and really have been over the last decade, as well as states that aren't doing so well. I'm sure that's a theme that is pretty familiar there in Canada. So you're right. It's always a balancing act because you want to have a constructive relationship with government. If you're constantly just bagging them, as we'd say here in Australia, you're not going to get very far.
I have never been accused of bagging someone, but I hope one day I am.
if you're constantly bagging, then you know they're just going to stop listening. So right. you've got to celebrate the successes where they occur. But by the same token, if you're not calling out missed opportunities, then you're not doing your job.
That's
a line that we work. But I'd say that the Energy Efficiency Council, we sort of tend to try and work constructively and, you know, call things as we see them, but try and move the conversation forward in a proactive way.
I want to talk a little bit about politics. We talked about this term bagging versus, you know, applauding. And, you know, an NGO has to, or an industry association kind of has to be, you know, nonpartisan and sort of neutral. But I think what you're seeing around the world is kind of, you know, policies are being driven on political rivalries. Mm. How do you deal with that in Australia? And are you in a point where you can call out the kind of bad actors versus the ones that are driving the right policy, or do you kind of have to be friendly with all the various different parties? You never know when they're going to be in power.
It's important to say there are a range of roles in the kind of the advocacy ecosystem. There are people that, you know, their role is to just, you know, tear the place down, you know, to call out bad faith, to kind of, you know, if we're not doing all the things we need to be doing like 5 years ago, then, you know, you're dead to me. Like, that is a role.
That is
not our role. Our role is as an industry association. We're probably more middle of the road. And, you know, where the view of our board is that you need to be able to have conversations with all sides of politics, because ultimately, if we're going to do this thing, we need to build a consensus in the center of politics, which is resilient. That's the thing. Like, it's not, this is not, this view of, you know, the role that we play is not like us going, oh, we're just going to, you know, roll with, you know, whatever the government of the day says. It's actually my theory of change, the one I subscribe to, is that you need to do everything you can to build that consensus in the centre, and you don't do that by yelling at people, at least not all the time. Maybe you need to yell at some of the time. We talked about that earlier, but you can't, you're not going to get them on board by yelling at them all the time. And so, you know, my job is to find the arguments and find the mechanisms to get to a point where energy efficiency is just completely uncontroversial and everybody sees that it's what we need to get on with. And what I would say is, while there's been some contention around climate policy, particularly at the national level in Australia, what observers around the world that have got a vague idea about what's happening in Australia probably don't have this sort of granular knowledge, is that there's a very high degree of consensus at the state level, and that's for progressive and conservative governments. Indeed, the New South Wales government and the Energy and Environment Minister, Matt Keane, is one of the foremost champions of the economic opportunity around net zero, and he's in many ways leading the national debate on that front. And particularly, and we've talked about this, Corey, in countries like ours, which are kind of very dependent on extractive industries, we've enjoyed cheap energy for a really long time, and that's kind of been one of the foundation stones of our economy. This is a pretty, you know, challenging transition, and we need to find ways of both maintaining momentum without kind of blowing up the consensus, because what I have seen in Australia is that you can lose a lot of time if, you know, all of a sudden, you know, a political consensus crumbles and you don't have both sides of politics on board.
Right. And then you're starting from scratch again. Yeah. We are really starting to feel and see the impacts of climate change. And I know this is a big issue in Australia with wildfires, and now there's heat waves here. And British Columbia had a city in British Columbia yesterday had a 47.5 degrees Celsius temperature, which is obviously a record for them and for Canada. Mm-hmm. It's right in our face now. And I'm just curious, and Lindsay's kind of asking, how does that color your advocacy work? I know you're trying more in the center and you're building coalition and you're kind of building consensus, but at some point people need to kind of connect the dots between exactly what they're seeing right in their face to the policies that you're advocating for.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. And like, building consensus doesn't mean kind of sugarcoating the reality. And we're very upfront about the challenge that is being faced and the need to drive that transition. You know, the conversation in in Australia is very much focused around net zero. You know, net zero can sort of devolve into a hashtag. Like, people are either for it or they're against it, and they don't even really understand what it means. But right. It's kind of like, you know, it can divide along partisan lines. The thing that we try and do and the contribution that we try and make, and we're kind of uniquely placed to do so in the energy efficiency sector, I mean, in terms of energy sector bodies, is to talk about net zero as a useful concept if you break it down and think about what, you know, it's actually about what the transition pathways are for different parts of the economy to get to a given outcome. Thinking through what the, you know, what's happening in a particular building, what's happening on a particular manufacturing site, what's happening in a particular sort of resources site. And so we come from a very grounded place. And what I'm observing with our members is that it's the energy managers that are transitioning neatly and seamlessly into the role of carbon managers, because it's a lot of the same skills, right?
Right.
And in many cases, energy is the most significant sort of chunk of carbon abatement that's available to businesses, or often the most cost effective source of carbon abatement for businesses. And so what we're able to, and this is often the case, you've got this broad base of members, and our job is to kind of capture all that information, then feed it back up. And what we're trying to feed back up is saying, look, we need to unpack this conversation. This conversation is way too high level. We need to talk about what's going on in the manufacturing sector. We need to talk about what's going on in commercial buildings, residential. And then you can start to talk about, well, what are the interventions and how, and, you know, what are the practical things that we can do in the next, you know, not in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, but the next 2 or 3 years to kind of drive us towards that. Like, net zero, great. What are we doing next year?
Yeah,
that's the question.
Exactly, making that connection. One of the things we've been successful at, I think, is matching out of COVID, matching kind of this, at least in Canada, this desire from the federal government and definitely some of the provincial governments, the desire to quote unquote build back better, is what they call it. So trying to match, this economic recovery and kind of bringing the economy back from COVID, but matching that directly with climate ambition. And our government has, like many other governments and many corporations, kind of committed to net zero. I'm not entirely sure they know exactly what that means and how hard it's going to be. But I'm curious on your end, has there been that kind of level of discussion with the Australian government on kind of matching economic recovery, any kind of discussion of that, and then the role energy efficiency can play in helping make that happen?
Yeah, sure. So I'm sure like you there in Canada, were really impressed with the work of the International Energy Agency in the middle of last year, with the work they did with the International Monetary Fund, really highlighting the role of, I guess, clean energy broadly and energy efficiency in particular as a stimulus measure, and the multiple dividends that investments in energy efficiency, especially in like building upgrades, could deliver. And so we were really championing that work. And the response was mixed. It wasn't really picked up so much at the national level, but we had a couple of states who took it to heart, notably Victoria, where I am now. It's the second most populous state here in Australia, capital Melbourne. They announced a $1 billion energy efficiency stimulus package in their emergency budget back in October. And this is the most significant single spending measure from any state government on energy efficiency in Australia's history. And it kind of is the greatest hits of energy efficiency stimulus. You've got kind of residential building upgrades, you've got social housing, you've got working with manufacturers to improve their energy performance, you've got government building upgrades. They really sort of looked at the evidence from around the world in Victoria and took that to heart. The good thing that's happening though out of the Victorian spending is that it's driving program development and delivery in a whole bunch of areas that will be really crucial over the coming decade. And so it's driving policy and innovation, it's driving thinking about skills, it's driving thinking about supply chains. And so that's going to be, you know, not just establish sort of, some of those things here in Victoria, but there's going to be lessons learned out of that stimulus program in Victoria that can be, you know, spread right across the country.
Yeah, and I hope actually that happens everywhere, is that kind of foundational side. And that you mentioned kind of the skills and the worker side. For us, we're actually kind of excited when we get to have conversations with non-traditional departments, you know, in government. Like, it's always been on our end. Natural Resources Canada has always been kind of there. That's their mandate. It's, you know, they're in charge of it. You know, we can always work with them. But when you have a group like the department in Canada called the Employment Services Development Canada, their job is to just like grow jobs in Canada. Yep. When they're excited and interested in climate or green jobs and things like that, that's when we get excited, because then, you know, you're kind of bursting out of this bubble. And I've always felt like, you know, wouldn't it be great one day if there was no environment department, or there was no environment faculty at universities, that it was kind of ingrained throughout. So talk to me about that, and like the types of conversations you have kind of outside that like really small box of energy efficiency.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point, and it's one I would co-sign that. I went to the school at the University of Melbourne, and there's a professor called Robin Eckersley at the University of Melbourne. She wrote this great book called The Green State. It's if you're into sort of, you know, the governance of climate change, it's a cracking read. And the point of the Green State is that it is actually really counterproductive to have environmental and climate issues kind of siloed in an environment department. And actually, you've got to think about how they're integrated into the core of government. And ideally, that's, you know, governments are very hierarchical, and that means that the locus of these kind of conversations should be driven out of central agencies, should be driven, you know, in our systems, you know, the Prime Minister's Department and Treasury, you know. And it's really interesting when I observe, you know, some of the policies, and because we've got, you know, we've got federal system, we've got certain different structures, and this the energy efficiency sits in different places in different parts of the country. When Treasury is involved, stuff happens.
Yeah.
because all the other government departments are very used to listening. Just, you know, there's no kind of, oh, you know, yeah, what are you going to do? It's the environment department. You're going to hit me with a damp twig. No, it's the Treasury department. You actually do what they say. Yeah. There's no kind of ifs, buts, or maybes, you know, regardless of what the conversation is. And so forward-looking governments are aware of those power dynamics, and if they're serious about things like net zero, it's like, okay, we're transforming our economy, and that is not a siloed conversation. That is a whole of government conversation. So I've probably gone a bit broader than perhaps the question you asked me, but it's actually a topic I'm very passionate about, because for leaders, particularly political leaders, that are interested in driving systemic change, they need to start by changing government, and these concerns need to be integrated into every department right across government, including jobs, but also industry and health. Every part of government is impacted and needs to take a leadership position on this.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Hey team, Luke here. I hope you're enjoying this little 50th episode special that Corey and I have put together for you. I've had some guidance from my team, and that I should be doing more to let all of you know what's happening at the Energy Efficiency Council. So I'm going to start doing that from this episode and commit to circle back to you in future episodes. A few exciting things on the way. We are running a series of webinars on the topic of net zero. We're going to be talking to the European Commission around their Fit for 55 program. We're going to be talking to the International Energy Agency, looking at their net zero pathways program, and there's one or two more speakers that we're just lining up, all in the lead up to Glasgow and getting our heads in gear on what a productive outcome would look like coming out of Glasgow, and of course the role of energy efficiency and energy management in achieving our net zero goals. So if you want to play along at home and lob in a question for our guests, you should keep an eye out for those sessions, and you can of course visit eec.org.au/podcasts to get with the program. All right, now back to the episode.
18 out of 25 on the international rating, that doesn't matter to me. What matters is that everywhere across the world, someone's doing great stuff.
Yep.
And we can all learn from each other about their particular great thing. And one of the things that kept popping up in my feeds over the last little while is this Neighbours program that, mm-hmm. that you've been instrumental in getting off the ground. And it's the National Australian Built Environment Rating System. So talk to me about that, because I've seen, you know, other countries taking that on. It seems like it's this global leading initiative, and maybe like we don't have something like this. So maybe we can kind of just riff a bit on that so that that the listeners kind of understand what it is, how it came about, and maybe there's a chance we can bring it to Canada.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll start by saying I'm not personally responsible for Neighbours. It's been around since 1999. So
come on, take it.
I would regard myself as one of the many custodians of Neighbours. I do sit on the Neighbours Steering Committee, but there's plenty of people that have a deeper interest and a love of Neighbours here in Australia. National Australian Built Environment Rating System, as I say, developed in 1999 by the New South Wales government, importantly in collaboration with industry. And this is a rating system that covers all manner of sustainability metrics, but importantly for our conversation and really where it started was that it rates the actual energy performance of buildings. So this is not a rating that is focused on characteristics. It actually doesn't care about characteristics. It's about how a building actually performs. And there's different Neighbours energy ratings focused on different sectors. So you've got office buildings is the big one and where the biggest impact has been had, but it also rates shopping centres, data centres, hotels, hospitals, and the algorithms that generate these performance-based ratings are all tailored to the relevant metrics and the building type that they're addressing, and it really allows a like-for-like comparison. So, you know, it trundled along as a voluntary rating for a number of years, and then it's kind of had its first sort of uptick in kind of proliferation, and that was when the Australian government in 2005 said, you know what, we're going to require all our tenanted buildings to have a Neighbours rating. And all of a sudden, industry's like, oh, what's going on? You know, if we want to, the Australian government as a tenant, we need to have a Neighbours rating. What's all this about? That sort of, you know, drove greater integration and collaboration with industry. And then in 2011, sure. The Australian government came in and said, you know what? Every office building that is above 2,000 square metres has to disclose their Neighbours rating at point of sale and lease. So that, obviously, again, another big uptake. And then in 2017, that threshold was dropped to 1,000 square metres. So at this point, we have 78% of offices rated right across the country. Neighbours ratings are associated with higher occupancy rates, higher rents, higher property values. They've really become a proxy for building quality.
Wow.
And since their inception, you know, they've avoided $1 billion in energy costs, and they've cut 7 million tons of CO2 emissions. So this is the crown jewel of the Australian energy efficiency landscape. It's an incredible collaboration between industry and government. There's more that we can do, and there's a lot of work that's underway to expand. The goal of the Neighbours program is to get to a point where they're rating every single type of non-residential building in Australia. That's where the focus is at the moment. It's on non-residential buildings. And potentially, you know, there's an ongoing conversation and, you know, some recommendations sitting in government, which would see the disclosure regime expanded beyond office buildings to other subsectors. And so we're incredibly proud of it. And as you say, it's sort of been starting to be picked up around the world. So New Zealand adopted it in 2012. We've just seen the UK adopt it. And this is very, very hot off the presses. November 2020 was when Neighbours UK was started. And we've just released a report here at the Energy Efficiency Council, which was looking at opportunities for collaboration between Australia and Germany. And we found through that process that Germany finds itself in a very similar position, I think, to Canada, based on what you've said over our last few conversations, in which that there's kind of no equivalent kind of rating system. There's no equivalent disclosure regime for commercial buildings. And there's interest in kicking the tire on Neighbours playing a role there in Germany as well. So,
wow,
it's something that, you know, when we think about, you know, all the work we do in this sector and impact, that insight that you just pointed to, that everywhere around the world, you know, everyone's doing some stuff really well. And given the rate of transition that we're working our way through, we don't have time for all of us to kind of recreate systems and processes, you know, 180 times in 180 different countries. We just need to beg, borrow, steal, you know, collaborate. Yeah. Here you go. Work with this. It worked for us. Just, you know, really rapid kind of translation and sharing and just making stuff happen. And if Neighbours is our contribution to that, I would be absolutely delighted.
Oh, it'd be huge. Right. Yeah. Because we peg that up. And I'm happy to steal it from you. So we may just do that.
It's not actually technically mine, but sure.
I know. But when we convince the federal government here to do it, then I'll just say it's Luke. So we could talk about that. Could be a whole other thing. One of the challenges we have is this federal provincial kind of jurisdictional issue. And in Canada, Ontario, where I live, our most populous province, is the only one that has a building benchmarking law. There's kind of rumblings from others, and now some municipalities, some cities are trying to do it, which creates this kind of fragmented approach because, you know, developers and property management companies and stuff, they've got buildings everywhere. So it's just frustrating that you have to have different things. So, like, I know you weren't around right at the beginning, but having that national approach and just basically saying everyone and then 78% of the buildings comply, I mean, that's a huge win in and of itself. So how did that happen?
I think what was really important in the Australian context was the fact that it wasn't mandatory immediately. So there was kind of time for industry to sort of get their head around what it meant. And even that in 2005, when the Australian government adopted it as, you know, you need a Neighbours rating. And over time, that's been adopted by state governments around the country. And now it's like you need a minimum Neighbours rating. It's 1 to 6. So, you know, you might need a minimum Neighbours rating is 4 to even, you know, be in running for a procurement contract. And that's why I told the whole story. There was a long pathway from 1999 when, you know, the first kind of Neighbours energy rating was developed through to 2017 where every building over 1,000 square metres needs to be rated. So and it was knocking the bugs out of the system, getting confidence from the industry, and then having regulation which was sensible, very light touch. Like nobody has to do anything. There's no minimum Neighbours rating. If you have a one star, then, you know, good luck to you. See how you go in the market.
Yeah.
It's just, it's about transparency and consumer protection so that, you know, it's just providing another information or data source for tenants and potential, you know, property buyers to say, well, you know, what's going on with this building? You know, what are the implications going to be for my energy bills? And so I think it's that going on that journey over a period of time that has really helped. And now, you know, you find we're in a situation now where industry has a huge sense of ownership over Neighbours. The governance is fascinating. We can schedule another one of these one day to talk about Neighbours governance. We thrill your listeners, I'm sure, with that conversation.
There are enough nerds out there that would love to hear it, I'm sure.
But it's actually run by the New South Wales government still, who's got we've got the federal government, all the state governments on the steering committee, along with industry. So there's 8, 9, 10 industry representatives sort of balancing out, and decisions around Neighbours are made collaboratively within that group. So it's a really interesting case study. Now, you know, it's the way that Neighbours roll out in Australia is a little bit unique, and it's not necessarily going to be the way that it's going to achieve success in other jurisdictions. But the building blocks are there, and the lessons are there. So it's insights we're happy to share, Corey.
I want to make sure we chat about some of your success in driving policy, because if you were to step back and think of the most kind of impressive campaign or project that the Energy Efficiency Council has run, what would it be? The one that captured the most attention, the one that kind of you feel moved the needle, and maybe even one that you were most proud of?
I was really actually proud of our work last year. So I talked about the work that the IEA did, and it was incumbent upon us to really amplify that here in Australia. You know, it's and again ground it in what was going on in an Australian context. And so we held a summit in, I believe, early July last year, sort of early months of the pandemic, everyone's scrambling, and we were able to pull together a bunch of global and local experts. We did it in collaboration. It wasn't an Energy Efficiency Council thing. It was Energy Efficiency Council, peak body for the property sector, peak body for Australia's manufacturing sector, and our peak body for the social services sector. So a cross-sectoral kind of grouping. And it was one of those things where it's not always the thing that you spend the most time on that is the most impactful. We sort of went from idea to running this thing in about 2 weeks. And we had and it was all online, so it was kind of in the early days. It was all getting and as you can see, I've got my microphone, and you know, we're very well set up these days. It's all kind of old hat, but we were still all working. We were working it out in early July last year, and it was just incredibly well attended. With you know, 2 weeks' notice, we had almost 1,000 people from around the country dialed in, and then it was kind of, you know, the ripple effects out from that kind of that cohort that were listening in, and then that were effectively activated by that session. You know, to the degree, like, there are many, you know, parents of success, I think the saying goes. And so, you know, I don't want to take credit for what the Victorian government subsequently did. There were a lot of people that made a contribution to that, and there are indeed other organisations that are doing flagship reports and, you know, really beating the drum. But it was kind of like one of the things that kind of, you know, really drove the conversation around the role of energy efficiency and stimulus right up the agenda. And we've sort of taken lessons from that. There's an awful lot around digital engagement that we had on the to-do list for years. Small organization, I've got 10 staff. Our remit is a little bit bananas, like in terms of the stuff that we're trying to cover off. And so, you know, there's all these things that you think, oh, that'd be nice, but you never get around to it. But of course, we had to lean into digital last year, and we found the effort to impact ratio on a lot of that stuff was really, really good. And so we know we're maintaining the webinars, and we're doing the podcasts, and we're doing all of those different bits and pieces, because you're in a position to reach more people than you ever could if you tried to put them in a room. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the world didn't have a dedicated energy efficiency podcast before. We didn't.
Did it need one?
No, come on. We did need one. It's great to be a host because then you can have the final word. But I was kind of joking before, but I'm serious. I mean, your podcast that you've launched is great. And it's not, you know, it's not great just because of your guest, but you have a really good skill in being able to tease out various different things and lessons and things like that. And you have obviously Australian, you know, people in it, but you also have people from around the world. I was, you know, happy to be a guest on it. I know Steve Nadell from ACEE's been on it. There's been lots of different people on it. What's like the number one lesson or the thing you've learned from doing this? And I'll just say also, I hope you do more because they are great.
It's been a great pleasure doing the podcast. I don't have any plans to stop anytime soon. For me, and I'm going to share something here. In the olden days, I would have coffee with people. Pre-COVID, I would have coffee with people, and that would be the way that I would kind of prime the pump of my thinking and kind of get the new thinking and kind of then I'd sort of distill it and feed it back into our work. And that just stopped, like, you know, in a very dramatic way when COVID hit and we went into that first round of lockdowns. The podcast was a very selfish way for me to continue having those conversations. And it was also, you know, I worked out, and part of the reason why we kept doing it is it was filling a space for our community, not just in Australia, but around the world. And it was, you know, half an hour each week where people could, you know, stick some earbuds in and they'd be sort of hearing or feeling like they were part of some of the conversations that they would have been having if they weren't sort of stuck at home, with toddlers crawling all over them or whatever. People have been very kind, and it's, you know, we've been really thrilled at the response. We have 70% of our listeners here in Australia, but 30% of them are global. And, you know, it's a great honour to be talking to people right around the world with the podcast. But the thing that I've learned, to answer your question, is that I kind of mentioned it earlier. It's just, we're just dealing with all the same stuff everywhere around the world. Like, that's the thing. Like, and there's so much commonality in the kind of the challenges and the opportunities associated with the demand side. It's undervalued everywhere. Everywhere. Like, there's no country in the world that has really nailed this thing of kind of really getting a big Sharpie and underlining and making people understand how absolutely crucial it is. We interviewed the founder of Bloomberg New Energy Finance. It was like episode 8 or episode 9. I said energy efficiency, it's almost impossible to get to net zero without leveraging energy efficiency. And he said to me, no, Luke, you need to stiffen your spine. It is impossible. You cannot do it. You cannot do it. And it's those sorts of interactions which kind of go, yeah, you're right. Like, we need to actually call it for what it is and actually tell those stories. And it is by building this community across the world rather than us being like, the Efficiency Canada, Efficiency Council here in Australia. It can feel a little bit like being the prophets in the night. It's got a very lonely experience because you've got all these different sort of competing priorities and you're sort of banging the drum for energy efficiency. But we're actually, when you join the dots between the organisations, the individuals working around the world, then, there's a commonality of purpose. There's an incredible amount of passion, lovely people and strength in numbers. And if we work together and we share those stories, then, we're going to get it done is kind of what I've taken out of it all. But we need to join the dots and we need to collaborate and we need to leverage off each other's strengths. We need to program everybody to take neighbours and, spread it around the world, all of those things. If we do all that, we'll be in good shape.
That's great. And that's a great way to end it. And I really do thank you for your role in doing that. And the only thing I'll add to that about the commonalities across the world is our sense of humor. And I think that you in particular, somehow you and I are on that same wavelength. So, but thank you so much. And I think that what you're doing in Australia, there's definitely things we can learn from here in Canada. Likewise, we'd love to kind of, work together with you on some things we're doing that you could bring to Australia and then around the world. So this has been great.
Love it. Thanks, Corey.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have any comments, you can find us on Twitter. You can find Luke at Luke Menzel, LukeMenzel. And to keep up to date on the latest from Canada's National Voice for an Energy Efficient Economy, follow us at Efficiency Can. That's at EfficiEncyCan. Now, if Twitter's not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au. Make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. And to learn more about the show, including upcoming live recordings, visit us at eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you down the road.
There you go. It'll be interesting to see what folk make of that.
Like, it'll just be like the fourth dimension mirror inversion.
Continue
with that.